Welcome to the Free From Wall Street podcast, where we talk about how to create, preserve, and pass on generational wealth without the roller coaster ride of the stock market. And now, here's your host, Stephen Libman, managing partner of Integrity Holdings Group.
Welcome back to the Free From Wall Street podcast. My name is Steve Libman. I'm the managing partner of Integrity Holdings Group. We have a real fun show today. I've been excited about this one for a while now. We've been joking about having you come on the podcast, but I have a good friend of mine. We've known each other for over a decade now, Aaron, the Aaron Fisher. What's up, man?
What's up, man? Yeah, I think it's two decades now. We're old.
Oh my God, we are old. You're right.
Well, yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm pretty psyched, and I think it's cool that that you do this.
Yeah, we're like a fine wine to get better with age, though. So it's
yes.
So we were just talking offline a little bit. So for those of you that don't know, Aaron and I at Boston University together. Aaron he holds a special place with Integrity Holdings Group. He was the first man to write a check as a private investor to give us his hard-earned money and let us deploy it and make him a bunch of money by doing so. But that took a good level of know, like, and trust, right? We had to build that
correct
up over time. And but we are forever grateful for you, man. Since then, we have raised and deployed probably about $25 million and made a bunch more people some passive income as well. But it all started back at our buddy Ryan's wedding. Right? Was it Ryan's wedding or Greg's wedding?
No, it was Ryan's. It's kind of funny too, because first of all, the check I wrote was way under that $25 million you've raised by quite a few zeros, commas.
It's a good start.
It's kind of a funny story. So it was our friend Ryan's wedding, and I'll give Ryan the benefit of the doubt that this part's true, but my invitation was lost in the mail. So he called me a few weeks before the wedding and was like, dude, are you coming? And I was like, what do you mean? I never got an invitation. But it worked out where I could go. So I went there. And yeah, that was kind of the birth. I remember Steve and I talking. I had recently taken out a home equity line of credit against a condo I owned with no idea what I was going to use the money for, right? Which is the beauty of a line of credit. You don't need to know. And I remember you were talking about how you were wholesaling, development projects. And we're like, I want to kind of cherry pick the best ones for myself. And yeah, that was kind of like the birth of that idea. And eventually, I think we each formed our own companies around it. And, you know, I'll say I'm very like proud to have been involved early. But more, I'm honestly like proud and happy for your guys' continued success. Like, it's cool to think, yeah, I made money off of it, which is obviously why I got involved. It wasn't totally out of the goodness of my heart, but it did turn into something that's now seems like it's good for a ton of people, which is really cool.
Yeah, Ryan, Aaron, and I lived together for a couple of years in Boston and didn't really have I don't think a lot of people in college know exactly where they're going to be in 15 years. I mean, so we were still learning a lot of stuff together, just learning how to grow up and things like that. And then, fast forward to this wedding, we start talking about, hey, I want to do some flips. We partnered, started making some money together. And, you know, what I find awesome about what you just said was, you know, how many other people we've come to help through that. So not just our investors, right? But you know our invest with purpose theory, which is in every single one of these deals that we do, we're carving out an equity position for a nonprofit. We will give away over $1 million over the next 4 years with partnerships that have already been created to these nonprofit groups that are saving girls from sex trafficking, digging wells in West Africa. We're building a Tom's River Field of Dreams here. We're partnered with those guys for a 100% disabled, accessible baseball park, bocce fields, all these cool things. So, you know, through these deals, we get to help a lot of people. And it's awesome to see from the investor side that you recognize that as well, because your returns are great. Tax savings are great, but look at what else we're able to do.
Yeah. Actually, with everything kind of going on right now, the deal that we have going now, I've been donating all the profits to charity as well.
That's awesome. Oh, that's awesome. I did not know that.
Not $1 million, but.
Well, what's cool is, you know, many hands make light work. So together we can do a lot more than we would ever be able to do separately, which is kind of the power of the syndication, right? It's the power of the group investment.
And something kind of cool to note for me anyway was, you know, when Steve alluded, we were living together. I was actually a real estate agent in Boston at the time.
That's right.
So that was kind of when I was getting my roots into understanding some of the process and stuff. And to be honest, I always look at that as what gave me the foundation to be confident in investing in real estate. You see enough property, you realize, man, renting it out isn't this impossible task. It kind of, you know, brings it into light that this is just a job I can handle.
Yeah.
You know, you see other people do it who are not geniuses or, you know, they're just people like everyone else.
Yeah, it's the 4-minute mile, right? Nobody thought that the 4-minute mile could be broken, and then somebody did it. And then I think in 3 times that year, somebody continued to break it.
I'd say it's more like the 10-minute mile. It's like everyone can do it. Like, you don't have to be exceptional. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. Yeah. No, and that's – so, yeah, so let's talk a little bit about your background. I mean, you're not just a real estate investor by trade. So what else do you do after Boston University? Where'd you go? What happens? What are you doing now?
Yeah, so I've definitely had a very untraditional path, right? So after school, I was a real estate agent in Boston for a few years. I moved back to New Jersey where I grew up. I did get my license down here, but that wasn't my full-time job. I started managing nightclubs and teaching Kaplan SAT review courses for several years. When the crisis hit in 2008...
You did throw a killer party, by the way.
Yeah, I was really good at that
when
I was younger. Ironically, now I'm terrible at it.
Now I just want to take a nap.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, like the retired athlete that doesn't even like watch the games anymore.
Right.
But anyway, so like when the crisis in 2008 hit, was the first time I bought a property myself. I had invested with some others in like a new construction before that. That was about it as far as on the investing side. So I bought this foreclosed on condo. It was in bad shape. I had some friends that had just started their own construction business. So again, a little bit of like trust with people, you know, I was kind of their first like total remodel. So remodeled the condo. At this point I kind of said, hey, I don't want to do nightlife the rest of my life. Kind of snowballed into law school. And I ended up living in the condo. I thought I would rent it out, but I ended up living in there during law school. When I graduated, I moved out, started renting it. And that's around the time where I got, like I said, that home equity line of credit. And it's funny because I was thinking about this earlier. I can't remember where I learned about a HELOC, what sparked the idea to do it. And my guess is it was someone I knew telling me about it, or you know, I just don't remember, but it turned out to be like such a blessing because I ended up getting the home equity line of credit. I had, you know, luckily had enough equity in the property that it mattered. And then when you and I met at that wedding, which was like a few years later, so now I'm a lawyer at like a technology company or whatever, in New Jersey, that's when we met and, you know, started the idea of, yeah, let's start flipping some houses together. The cool thing about that is like we made all those first deals were basically made with other people's money, right? We just borrowed it against a condo I owned that was getting rented out. Yeah. And I think that's something to me that like the average person doesn't understand about real estate is that you're not like, unlike many other investments, your money isn't tied up in the house. It's parked there. And you can typically borrow against it at somewhat favorable terms to put somewhere else too.
Yeah.
So you can get dangerous with like over leveraging that, but it's a good avenue. It's like, I didn't stow that money away in a condo and just collect rental income. I did that. And then I don't know what we probably flipped over 10 houses together in the, you know, it's only been like 5 years since that happened, right? Five, six years. that's something I'm always confused when someone's like, I'm going to buy a house, but I'm not sure because I also want to. No, you can do both.
Yeah. And it's just economics, right? So, I mean, if the cash flow or the profit outweighs the cost of the debt service, then you're winning, right? Especially when you're using bank leverage. I mean, so I've been in this game for 11 years now, and, you know, we've bought a lot of different types of properties, and rates are really low right now. So I just refinanced my primary residence. The value went up a little bit, and I found a company that'll do a 95% combined loan to value. So they gave me over six figures in a home equity line of credit, and we're putting it into our own deals, right? We're just reinvesting that capital because I'm borrowing it at 4, I'm making 12, so I'm arbitraging 8, and I'm making cash flow on it. So it just makes just economics, right?
Yeah, I'd say it's like what you hear about the stock market: buy low, sell high, borrow low, invest high. Same idea.
Exactly. Yeah, and with rates where they are right now, I mean, it's a good opportunity for people to do that. And I know a lot of people that are pulling money out of the stock market right now too. I mean, we are obviously
for me with that, it's kind of a diversification aspect. Like, I'm not going to say I don't have money in the stock market.
Sure.
What I will say is I think it's foolish to have all your money in the stock market. I also think it might be foolish to have all your money in, you know, one property that you're flipping or whatever. 100%. You know, one thing I realized kind of doing my own research about, you know, investing and wealth and stuff is that people who are successful tend to have more than one income stream and more than one strategy. And, you know, it's funny, I worked when I was in law school in entertainment and now in technology, and you kind of find the same approach in a lot of industries, right? Like venture capital, music industry, movies, they all invest the same way, right? Which is you don't put all your money in one movie or one artist you're signing or one small tech startup. You put it in, you know, 10, and then the one that actually makes it makes up for all the other losses. And you kind of have to have that same mentality investing, although hopefully your success rate will be higher. Because I mean, in those industries, it's literally one Avengers movie makes up for like nine movies you're going to lose money on. And you know that. You're just not sure which one of them will be the, you know, billion-dollar blockbuster. Same thing in investing in companies. In real estate, you want to make money every time, but you're not sure which ones will be like, oh, we killed it in this
bigger
one. So, you know, just diversifying does make sense. And then you can, you know, weather any storms which do come and are unforeseeable.
Yep. And, you know, what the pivot that we made from the residential flips that we were doing together till now, what we're doing in commercial is there's additional tax advantages to it. It hedges our downside risk even further because we're not buying a vacant house and we don't know what's going to happen with the market in the future. We have a good idea, but we don't really know. Now we're buying cash flow, right? We have 220 tenants that are paying their bills right now. This is the cash flow. This is the debt service. It's much more predictable than the 10 years of house flipping that we did.
100%.
You know what I did see? And to your point about diversification, I like to look at like the Harvard and Yale endowment funds, right? Because they have to disclose through the endowment fund where their money is. And both of them have between 22 and 28% in real estate. Yeah. And then the other stuff is diversified into kind of low yield, more like bonds, some higher yield private equities, and a couple of different other things. But I think that's an interesting thing to go and look at is what does smart money do with their money?
Yeah, right?
I mean,
exactly.
The Harvard and Yale endowment fund in the tens of billions of dollars now. I mean, it's not hard to find where these people are investing and saying, oh, maybe I should do that.
Yeah, the one thing I'll say, though, is I think that there's different mentalities, like on the depending where you're at, like when you are starting off and looking to acquire a bunch of money or whatever. Like at that point, you might want to take higher risk investments so that you can get a higher return. But it's funny, once you have money or what you consider a good amount of money, your mind kind of shifts to protecting it, right?
Sure.
I don't need to make a 10x here. I just don't want to lose it and make something off of it. And so I think in that case, if that's what you're looking to do, then yeah, the endowment funds make sense because they're in that category of like, we need to preserve this long term.
Yeah. And right? we always say that we have three things that we look at when we look at deals now too, is the number one thing is preservation of capital, right?
Right.
The number two thing is return on investment, right? And then the number three thing is return of investment. When are we going to get that money back after we deploy it? And I think if you look at it from that lens, then yeah. And look, they, even those endowment funds, they have some aggressive stuff in their portfolio, but they also have tens of billions of dollars. So they're looking to preserve a lot of it too.
That's my point, right? Yeah. And if like you're starting out with your first investment, you might be willing to take more risk so that you can get to
pour a little gasoline on the fire.
More conservative. Yeah, exactly. I'm just saying like that's one thing when you like when you're saying you look at basically you're looking at institutions or people or whatever that have money.
Yeah.
Part of you what you want to do is look at how they got there, and then the other part is what they do once they're there. Because they're typically not the same strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point.
So what you'll see is like, yeah, anyone who has money knows to put some in real estate.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? For sure.
Yeah. So you're an attorney, you have a W-2 job, you're making some passive income on the side through real estate investment. What's the ultimate goal? I mean, is this just kind of wealth building strategy long term, or are you, you know, going to retire earlier, or like what's the goal of being an investor?
It's a good question. My feeling has kind of shifted, to be honest, over time. I still have this goal of, I like being a landlord. I think that's kind of a cool job and role. Mostly because I do really enjoy real estate and whatnot. So part of my goal is to build up, you know, more of a rental portfolio. But I've also realized, like, I don't know that I'll ever truly want to just be retired with, like, nothing, no actual responsibilities and whatnot. And I think mentioning the W-2 part is, like, you know, if you work for good companies and whatnot, you have other investment opportunities through the company, right? So things like 401ks, if they're matching or whatever.
Yeah, it's free money.
The company I work for now is, yeah, exactly. We're a publicly traded company. So we have like some stock incentive programs. So I think like you want to just see what's available to you and kind of maximize every potential avenue. But yeah, no, my goal is definitely, right now I'm still in kind of like the build out the portfolio kind of mindset, with the goal of, I don't know if I'd say retiring early, but just having more choice, right? Like, would I want to spend my time doing something else? Not because I need money, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of everyone's goal. And I've learned this a little bit from my family members, seeing them retire. I used to never think about retirement. I only thought about making more money. And then I've seen my dad and some of my aunts and cousins like get to the age and the ability to retire. And man, they're just so happy. Like, you know, for example, my father, he still teaches part-time. So he likes teaching. He doesn't do it because he needs, you know, what a part-time teacher makes. He does it because he likes it. It keeps him busy. He's happy. He gets to pursue his other passions. My aunt's traveling all the time. She's, you know, so I used to think about, oh, I want to just be super rich. But now it's more like, I just want to enjoy myself more often.
It gives you options, you know?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people say it's freedom. That's.
Yeah. You'll have people, you know, that are the naysayers that are like, you know, you're too focused on the money aspect. And it's like, first, you know, I love what I do. I enjoy those types of investing. I like the strategy of it, right? I like math. And it gives you time freedom, right? It's nice to be able to say, I'm taking a couple weeks with my wife and kids and going on an RV trip if I decide to do that, you know? So,
yeah. I mean, one thing I find though is like people don't, they don't, the, at least the people I know that are like the most successful, it's not because they're chasing the money. It's just part of doing something they like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you found a way and it's not like you hate real estate, but you're good at it, so you do it anyway. Or I hate being a lawyer.
Right.
You know, and you find a place or whatever, or an avenue that you can do those skills, and like the money part's going to come. And I think a lot of the people that view it the other way, like, just have never experienced both at the same time. You know, like, you're making money and you're happy where you're at.
Right. It can be both.
It takes a while to get there. But Yeah, exactly.
And you have to test and measure some different things. Like, you know, we shut down a, you know, multi-million dollar business in the last 24 months and moved into another multi-million dollar business. But it was because I didn't love flipping. I mean, it was good. It was a good income earning. But, you know, there were some parts of that very transactional business of doing hundreds of transactions a year that I just didn't love. Now we get to do both, right? We get to make our investors money. We get to find deals that we really love. We don't have to execute on 150 of them a year. So yeah, you have to pivot, right? You have to be open to that mindset. Before we get too far, I want to point out, if you're listening to the audio of this, you probably didn't see me smiling ear to ear as Aaron was talking about his portfolio, because it flashed back to college. And I was like, I didn't ever think we'd be sitting here having this conversation about our portfolios. So.
We're trying to figure out who had dollar drafts on what night, so we can afford to go out.
That's exactly.
The other thing I'd like to mention before I like it slips my mind, because I know I think a lot of your audience are early investors. Like, I mean, to be honest, I kind of consider myself that too sometimes, like depending on what area. The one thing I know is that you don't really do any of this alone. Every deal or anything I've done that has made me money has been with other people. So I think who you partner with and like who you choose to partner with is super important, but also you can't be afraid to do it. You know, kind of, we were talking earlier, Steve did not make his multi-million dollar business by himself, right? I didn't flip these houses by myself at all, honestly. Like, I was kind of the passive investor.
Well, and you have another job, right?
So
you,
exactly.
Realistically, and are you able to do that?
That's kind of the point I'm making a little bit is like, it takes some risk and it takes other people. And I think a lot of times the world tells you to be weary of that. It's true. You partner with the wrong people. There are people out there who will look to rip you off or can't come through or whatever. But, you know, even the company I'm at now, it's like, you know, we're one of the more successful tech companies in the past couple of years. And you realize it's not because of me. It's because of everybody here. We've done such a good job of hiring the right people, giving them responsibility. You know, and you kind of got to do that. And then the other thing I would say is like, when you find the right partners, let them do their thing.
Right.
Like I remember just going, if I want, you know, Steve and his guys to do the best work, I'm going to leave them the hell alone.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, so again, it all comes back down to trust. I have a friend and a partner in one of our deals now. He quotes Jim Rohn constantly, and he uses this one line, which I just love. And it's, nobody is smarter than all of us.
Yep.
And, you know, you see it at a big company, even though we're a small firm, we have a lot of partnerships that might not work directly with us, but we have a lot of partners. And, you know, it's amazing to watch kind of how that lives and breathes and metamorphosizes over time, that we get to use each other's strengths. And, you know, you get to lean on other people to help make you successful. I've said this before on this podcast, is, you know, success is a team sport.
Yeah.
There's no chance I get anywhere that I'm at right now without the amazing people around us.
And I think that's the big myth is like the, I mean, you see it in the investment world, like they idolize a specific person as like the founder of this, or their actual best skill was building a team of people that made that company or whatever it is they're working on, what it was. Do you know what I mean? Like Bill Gates didn't do it himself. And I'm sure he'd be the first to admit that.
Yeah. And I've read Jack Welch's book. And, you know, if you know anything about GE, massive, massive company. So everybody looks at Jack Welch as this brilliant guy, right? He created GE Financial. But as you read this book, what you start to recognize is his relationships
Built
that whole company. I mean, he took a guy who was and I'm going to get the departments wrong, but he took a guy from aeronautical engineering and put it in the head of plastics. Like, that guy didn't know anything about plastics, but what he did know was how to run a department, and he knew how to be personable. And so when I was reading that book, it really just hit me as a CEO, like, you have to let your people do their thing.
Right? 100%.
And when you do, they win. You know, we listen, Leif Babin, Navy
SEAL. If they're the right people.
If they're the right people, right? So, you know, we had a Navy SEAL operator, Silver Star winner on the show not too long ago. And we were talking about kind of what makes these great teams, these great cultures. And, you know, he said Extreme Ownership is his book. And basically he tells you how to own everything yourself, but also let other people own it too. So like, if it's gotta be my idea and you say, hey, Steve, I'd do it a little differently, right? And I think that's about 80% of the way. The best thing for me as a leader is to give you autonomy on that and let you do it what I consider 80%, because you're going to own it, right? It's going to be your idea. You're going to push it. And yeah, I mean, to your point, it's let people do their thing, right? You got to know, like, and trust them, build those relationships. And then, yeah, don't put yourself on an island.
You want to filter them up front. Who you partner with should be an yes. extreme filter. But once you partnered with somebody, you have to empower them to do their part, their way, to the best of their ability. I mean, I saw that in real estate, but you really see it at like a corporation where you're scaling so much. It's like, damn, how are we keeping doing this?
Yeah.
We don't have the time to micromanage people. You got to hire smart people and let them do their thing and hope it works out. But what you realize is, like, if you hire smart people and let them do their thing, it works out. Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. I think Patton said, like, you know, don't tell people what to do. Don't tell them how to do things. Tell them what to do and let them go figure it out.
Yeah. And for me, like, where the company I'm at now is Datadog, since I keep referring to it. You know, one thing there that has really helped me be successful is them letting me be the type of person I am in my job. Because I think for a lawyer, I am always feeling and being told that, like, you're not the traditional type of, like, I wouldn't expect you to be a lawyer, which I honestly take pride in. But
right. Yeah, exactly.
But it's true. And it's like, well, then how did it become a success for me? Well, because I'm a, you know, ironically, when you're allowed to do it your way, you tend to figure out a way that is best for you. And then you keep repeating that and refining it. And now you're, you know, doing it a way that isn't just someone else can step in and do it that way.
Yeah.
And you don't want them to.
And I think for at least at a corporation, I don't know, right? We don't run a big company, but I would assume that the smart people tend to be entrepreneurial, and when you do micromanage them, they flee.
Yeah, right? No, it's kind of interesting because, like, you know, not to talk about the corporate side too much, but one really cool thing I've had here is like the experience of I joined the company as a smaller startup. Now we're a publicly traded, you know, we have like a $25 billion market cap or something, right? It's kind of unbelievable. And all this has happened in a few years. Yeah. And kind of to your point, yeah, if you hire people where you need to tell them what to do and stuff, and that's not really a good fit for that kind of growth. So yeah, you do hire people that maybe haven't had that exact role, but if you've had it at another startup or another entrepreneurial type venture where, you know, the thing that you learn in those businesses is that you just got to figure it out.
Yeah.
Right. Like, oh, we don't have a head of HR yet. So this HR thing came up and someone has to figure it out. And it's like, not just the skill of figuring it out, but I think the ambition and self-assurance that you can are things in business that are like super important, because you're not going to know all the answers. And there are a million ways to do it, but you have to figure it out, make a decision, and move forward with it, and be willing to learn from it if it's a mistake.
Yeah. These special operations guys, they're incredible, right? And then what they say is war is like life magnified. So imagine what we're talking about on the battlefield, right? These guys say this all the time, like, if you're managing everything, you're managing nothing. Like, you need to make sure that the people around you have your six. You want to make sure that they're doing their job and doing it well. And you can't try to do their job with your job. So, you know, it's life skills. It's not just business. It's not just war. It's not just investing. I mean, it's the mindset shift that needs to be growth oriented and saying, hey, I'm going to get out of this rat race that people tell us to do, go to school, get a good job, put my money into stocks, bonds, 401ks, ETFs, and just live this kind of vanilla and then hope to retire at a certain time. It's like, no, you can take extreme ownership of these things. You can decide where to put your money. You can decide how to be different and how to make it work for your life. And it all starts with that mindset of like, hey, what, where do I need growth? Where do I need to have some self-introspection, right? And it's
yeah, and to put it in kind of like a real world context, you know, the houses me and Steve have flipped together, we've sold more of them that I never saw in person or stepped foot in than the ones that I did. Right. And that's like, hey, after time, guys, if you think we can make, I'm here to make money.
Right.
I don't care what color the wall is.
Yeah,
you think
yeah.
this is one we can make money on? Cool. Here's a check. Let's do it. Versus no, let me come down and vet it out. And no, you guys are good at that. I quickly learned, no, you identify deals way better than I ever will.
Yeah. And you read legal jargon way better than I ever will. So
yeah.
we stay in our lanes and we complement each other and we
For
win
real?
Together.
No, that's what building a team is, you know, not stepping on everyone's toes. And also just, you know, at some point you're going to have to say yes, not knowing 100% it's going to work out.
Yeah.
That's why you make money, especially in real estate, right? Like I've been with quarantine, I've been watching HGTV like a madman. And I saw a statistic the other day where they were like looking at, you know, houses you needed to renovate versus houses you could just turnkey. And it was like 73% of buyers just don't want to do any projects. And it's like, I never knew the statistic, but
right.
we knew that from the business. Like, yes, that's why there's money in flipping houses. It's because most people don't want to do it.
Yeah. I had guys at my house at 7 o'clock this morning grading out my backyard and building
yeah.
like a Belgian block wall. And I'm like, man, I wish this was done when I moved in, but
right. Yeah.
yeah homeowners don't want to buy a, you know, $400,000 house and dump a bunch of money and time and effort into it.
I'm always really thankful to be honest, because I like doing that stuff. Like for me, what I like about real estate is it's such a cool kind of like metaphor for life is like you walk into a place, it looks like shit. Sorry if I'm not supposed to curse. It looks terrible, right? It needs a ton of work. And at the end, you know, you put in hard work, you had the vision of what it could be, you turn it into a beautiful home that someone else is happy to move into.
Yeah.
It's this really cool, like visualization of improvement. And you can kind of use, you know, those same tactics really in a lot of avenues of life, but real estate is such like a tangible, like
right.
it used to be this, now it's that. All it took was some vision and work.
Yeah.
That's honestly the part of it I like the best is
yeah. Now we're doing it on a bigger scale, right?
Yeah.
Like we're doing 220 unit apartment complex right now. And, you know, we're going in and we're paving the parking lot, but it's going to cost 800 grand. Like it's a city, right? We're buying 48 buildings. It's a little city. And I get excited about that. Like, oh, we're going to spend all this money. And you know what fresh blacktop and fresh paint looks like. It's going to be tight, right? It's going to look nice.
Yeah.
We're going to do some exterior. We're going to do new windows, a couple new roofs. And then inside the units, we're doing all new floors, doors, carpet, paint, trim, black appliances instead of white old ones. Like just these little things, right? And we get rewarded for it. We get a higher rent rate for the tenants. And the tenants get a better place to live. Like we're putting a dog park in and... you know, we're doing some barbecue grills and some big playgrounds for the kids. Like we get to make a clean, safe environment for people to go home to, not just a place like where they're hanging their hat, right? It's like,
and
they get to go home.
And that's kind of the part sometimes that gets lost is like, there is a human aspect to real estate that I like too, is like you are creating a home for somebody. And the value is, yeah, it's the money, but the money just reflects that you've created something that someone else is saying has value to them, which
yeah.
is cool, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like art in some way.
Yeah. No, I love it. I love the conversation. It's true. I mean, and we, we tend to get deep, right? We always have, because we have this kind of other purposeful point of life. It's not just hustle and grind and make that money. I mean, of course, we're entrepreneurial in spirit, but we see these human sides of things, and it's a great feeling to be able to do those things for people, even in the single family houses, right? When we were selling a house to a family, and you drive by and you see the kids playing in the backyard, and you're like, oh man, cool, we created a cool place to live there. Now we get to just do it on a bigger scale.
Yeah, and I think even with like the, like we're saying, like the charities that we're sponsoring or whatever, it's, you just realize it's all connected. Do you know what I mean? Like the more good I can do for other people, the more that comes back to me. It's this really cool, like virtuous cycle. And real estate is I always looked at it like it's a part of everyone's life.
Right.
Like you tell me you don't write a rent check or a mortgage check, or like someone does for where you live, or you own it and you pay tax on it, whatever. You're in this world of real estate. So like educating yourself on it, and then understanding where you want to be in it in different scenarios is helpful. Like, for example, where I'm talking to you from right now, I rent here. Why? This area is super expensive to buy. It kind of makes no sense to pay that much above what rent is just to own the place in an area that I don't think is going to appreciate that much more.
Right.
So what do I do with the other money? I invest it with Steve and make money on it.
Right.
It really is a lot of like math on top of like what you want out of life. So I want to live here. I don't feel like tying my money up in a high end condo for, X amount of years or whatever. Figure out what that's saving me and put that money to work somewhere else. That's the math.
Yeah. And it's just economics, right? It's not difficult decisions to make. It's like, hey, do I want to be tied to here long term? Yes or no? And different cycles of life, right? Now I have a, house filled with kids and a wife, and different. Like, I'm not trying to be transient, right? I like to be home now all the time. So it's good.
Yeah. No. Well, yeah. I'm pointing out too, like you can invest in real estate differently, right? Like I don't even own where I live, but
people pay
me rent for where they live.
Right. It's a great point. So a ton of value, man. I love talking to you. Appreciate, the trust and the friendship, and, 20 years later, I'm at.
Yeah. I love you, man. And I'm super proud of like what, honestly, more the person you've become than just the financial success. It's cool to see, like, I think hopefully most people grow from when they meet in college. I know we sure have, and it's cool that we've kind of, without necessarily being attached at the hip, grown in a very similar direction with just kind of like who we are and what we care about.
Yeah, it's interesting to get on the phone after a couple of years, right, and start talking about different books that we're reading at the same time, right? I think we were reading Thinking Slow and Fast by Kahneman.
Yep.
It's like, oh, wait, you're reading that too? It's good to see this trajectory of like, hey, we're going to constantly be on this path.
Yeah, it's funny because although we knew each other for 20 years now, it's not like we were talking about this stuff then. So it has been like introduced to each of us later in life through either different avenues or whatever. But yeah, we're both, have a similar mindset, which is, it's an awesome thing to share, especially with people you have a history with.
Yeah, totally. Awesome, man. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I can't wait until lockdown is over so we can go grab bourbon together and you can come down to the beach and go swimming.
Absolutely. All right. Bye. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Aaron.
Yep.
See you, man.
Thank you for listening. Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and head over to freefromwallstreet.com and sign up for our free guides to help you and your family invest with purpose.